And I find myself astounded at why my party is in opposition to the treaty.
Conservative arguments for and against the Law of the Sea Treaty. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Sea Life Center cares for a very affectionate walrus calf.
He has flippers wrapped around you, and he just, if you try to leave, he's going to hold you down into the fact where he just doesn't want you to leave.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
A military jury has found an Army sergeant not guilty of negligent homicide in the death of an Army private based at Fort Wainwright who killed himself in Afghanistan. Sergeant Adam Holcomb of Youngstown, Ohio, was found guilty Monday on two lesser charges, maltreatment of a subordinate and assault. He faces a maximum of 2.5 years in prison. The 10-member jury deliberated for 2 hours in military court at Fort Bragg today after hearing closing arguments. Holcomb was the first of 8 soldiers to be court-martialed for the alleged racial hazing of Private Danny Chen, who killed himself last October. Throughout the trial, the defense painted Chen as an incompetent soldier disowned by his family. Prosecutors said Holcomb abused Chen because of his Chinese heritage and drove him to suicide. Chen was a member of the 3rd Battalion, 21st Infantry Regiment, 1st Striker Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division, based at Fort Wainwright, but was under the command of a Fort Bragg general in Afghanistan. The outlook for ratifying the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea this term in Congress is not good. Opponents have long said they worry about the treaty's infringement on the nation's sovereignty. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, specifics as to what that means are hard to come by.
Here's why Wyoming Senator John Barrasso opposes the Law of the Sea.
I look at a significant loss of sovereignty and loss of revenue for the United States. That's the way I've read it.
That's a pretty stock view of the treaty these days from Senate Republicans. And it's puzzling to veteran Indiana Republican Richard Lugar. He's the top Republican on the Foreign Relations Committee and has seen it stall twice in recent years. Every committee member voted for it in 2004, and only 4 opposed it in 2007. So, to Lugar, is the sovereignty argument gaining traction?
I frankly don't know. I think there are a number of think tanks and other groups right now that are not in favor of international treaties, and they have apparently persuaded a number of members to accede to their wishes.
One of those think tanks is the influential Heritage Foundation. Just blocks from the Capitol, it pushes conservative causes in Congress. And it helped craft the letter of opposition that dozens of Republicans signed on to. Stephen Groves works on international law at Heritage.
You know, we don't want to be exposed to baseless international lawsuits that violates our sovereignty. We don't want to have to share the wealth of our own continental shelf with the developing world under terms that we can't control. That's a violation of our sovereignty.
And you hear that very refrain circulating through Republican ranks in the Senate. Idaho Senator Jim Risch says he's actually read the 200-plus page treaty, and one provision jumps out at him more than the rest, one that he says would force the U.S. to accede to international environmental agreements, both current and future.
Meaning that if you sign this, you're binding yourself to Kyoto and all kinds of other unknown future treaties.
The Kyoto Protocol is a binding UN agreement to cut greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. has not signed on to it.
I was the United States ambassador in negotiating it.
It being the Law of the Sea. That's John Norton Moore. We'll let him introduce himself.
Appointed by Ronald Reagan as a member of the National Advisory Committee on Oceans and Atmosphere. I basically worked under and served under and followed the instructions of 3 Republican presidents. And I find myself astounded at why my party is in opposition to the treaty.
As the United States negotiator on the treaty, he's an ardent supporter of ratification. And he says his party is running a war of misinformation on hot-button issues, like environmental ones, issues that rally the party faithful. Moore says the claim that the law of the sea would force the U.S. into the Kyoto Protocol is an outright lie. Another concern, that the United States would have to share its revenues with other countries, he says, is a misrepresentation at best. By signing the treaty, the United States would secure a bargaining spot at the International Seabed Authority.
And that seat on the council carries a blocking vote ability over a number of issues, including amendments, including rules and regulations, and including distribution of funds.
In Moore's words, the U.S. would win more access to minerals than any other country in the world. And yet opponents say the gains just are not worth giving up the rights and freedoms.
I respect that view. I don't think that that's the case, or I think it can be fixed to ensure that that's not the case.
Arizona Senator John McCain says he wants the treaty to pass, though in his words, it's dead for now. And Groves, who is organizing the opposition, says there is no way the treaty could be amended to address the sovereignty concerns. But there is a sign that when the treaty does return, the opposing arguments may be a bit more nuanced. Ohio Senator Rob Portman, who's reportedly on the shortlist to be the Republican vice presidential pick, released his own letter of opposition with more specific concerns.
The litigation risk to the United States outweighs some of the potential benefits, and I think we've been able to work out on a bilateral basis in terms of the Arctic, for instance, with Russia, with Canada. Good arrangements.
Meaning the U.S. doesn't need the treaty. We can work with countries directly, like the U.S. has done with Canada and Mexico over claims to the outer continental shelf. Supporters will not let it die, and the list of them is long, including all the living former Republican secretaries of state. With Arctic drilling set to begin in earnest soon, mixed with the prospect of a Senate with even fewer moderates next year, advocates say now is a better time than ever to ratify the treaty. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Two more walrus calves are on their way to the Alaska Sea Life Center. Both were rescued near Barrow yesterday. One was found floating on an ice floe by hunters looking for bearded seal. The other one showed up on the beach in Barrow. Rafaela Stimmelmeyer is a wildlife veterinarian with the North Slope Borough. She says a representative from the Alaska Sea Life Center was landing in Barrow to pick up the first calf when she heard about the second one.
Both of them were not in such great body condition, so, you know, ribs were palpable. You could see some of the, you know, the hip bones protruding. So these calves most likely have been without nursing for quite a while. But it's hard to judge or to say how long.
The Alaska Sea Life Center started caring for another walrus pup from Barrow last week. All three are young males, and none of the calves appear to have the mysterious illness that's affecting marine mammals in the Arctic. Bruce Woods is a spokesman for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says it's unusual to have so many abandoned calves from one area in such a short time span.
That said, you know, we have seen abandoned walrus calves picked up on several occasions over the years. At this point, we don't know of anything that could be a specific cause in either all or any one of these cases. There seems to be adequate ice in the area from what we know, and the walrus are using the ice at this point.
The first walrus calf rescued by the Alaska Sea Life Center has been gaining weight since he arrived last week. And as he develops, scientists are hoping he can shed light on the illness affecting seals and walruses on the North Slope. APRN's Wendy Jonasson visited the Sea Life Center and has the story.
The abandoned calf is already attached to his human caretakers, and he's extremely affectionate. Tim Lebling is the stranded animal coordinator at the Sea Life Center. Lebling says the walrus waddles over to anyone in his room and rests his head on their lap.
He'll spoon us. He won't let you leave sometimes. He has flippers wrapped around you, and he just, if you try to leave, he's going to hold you down into the fact where he just doesn't want you to leave.
And when someone does leave the calf alone in the room, he starts whining. In just a week, Lebling says the mischievous walrus has already learned to open the door to his enclosure, presumably in search of his new human companions.
It can, if we don't lock the door, it's going to open the door hinge. You hear stories from zoos and aquariums that, you know, these guys will all of a sudden show up in their office because they're very good at being breakouts. So this guy is no exception.
But the walrus is much more than just a cute new attraction at the center. He has the potential to provide much-needed insight into a mystery illness that is affecting seals and walruses on the North Slope. At this point, very little is known about the illness, but Lori Polashek, marine mammal scientist at the Sea Life Center, is hoping the calf can change that.
If the walrus happens to eventually show signs of this disease, we can also track that disease in the calf and then learn ways to treat it, and then possibly can then help us turn around and help treat or deal with the disease in the wild.
Sick seals first began showing up near Barrow late last summer. They were covered in skin lesions and very ill. Dozens of seals died.
So by the time the animal comes on shore, and what happens is they come on shore with weeping wounds, and they're very lethargic or they are virtually unresponsive, the disease has reached a state that the animal is showing positive for everything, for fungus, for bacteria, for virus.
Scientists have found similar lesions on walrus and polar bears in the North Slope, but no deaths have been attributed to the disease in those animals. Scientists aren't even sure if the seals, walrus, and polar bears are suffering from the same thing, and very little is known about what triggers the illness or how it spreads. As the Arctic waters open with melting sea ice, Polashek says the disease has the potential to move to the east coast of the U.S. and Canada. She says if the walrus calf does not develop the disease, it shows the disease has a limited reach.
If this walrus is happy, healthy, and has no disease problems, that's good. And that tells us that there are animals that are uncontaminated by the disease.
As of right now, the calf is showing no signs of the illness, but is being monitored. Since he is already attached to humans, he is not a candidate to be reintroduced into the wild. Instead, the Fish and Wildlife Department will find him a home in an aquarium or a zoo where he can bond with other walruses instead of humans. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Johnson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, battling an invasive aquatic plant near Fairbanks.
It's already in the Chena River as well. It's in very small patches there, but if that infestation grew, that could really impact the salmon habitat.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation. Generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
Alaska isn't home to nearly as many invasive plants as the lower 48 states, but they are beginning to creep in. An invasive aquatic plant is invading a waterway near North Pole. During a plant survey in 2010, specialists discovered Elodia in Chena Slough. This summer, the Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District is testing an eradication method. KUAC's Emily Schwing joined the team in the slough.
Everyone eventually vacuums the living room carpet, the kitchen floor, even the inside of the car, but it's not often that you find a group of plant specialists vacuuming the mucky bottom of a slough.
Kind of experimenting with the best technique to actually suck up the plant, because they want to remove the roots too, or it'll just regenerate.
On any other day, Jonathan Lyon, a recreational miner, would have his portable suction dredge out in search of gold. But today he's using it to help the Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District suck up an invasive plant called Elodia. In dark green chest waders, Lyon is down on his knees in Chena Slough, guiding green plants and brown muck into a long underwater tube.
I was happy to do it because it's kind of a chance to do something on the front lines of conservation, literally on the front line.
If it seems like Lyon is talking about waging war, that's because he kind of is.
Next summer, we're going to be in the slough. We're going to have suction dredges. It's going to be loud.
Darcy Echeverry is an invasive plant specialist with the Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District, and she's leading the charge against Elodia.
We're going to be asking landowners along the slough for access to their property so we can take equipment in and out, and maybe even asking for landowners to help dispose of the material that we're dredging out. And getting agency support is huge. You know, we're the Soil and Water District here in Fairbanks. We need the resources of the Department of Fish and Game, the Department of Transportation.
Elodia has taken root over approximately 10 miles, or nearly 55 acres, of Chena Slough. This particular species is native to North America, but its range only extends to southern British Columbia. It has small, bright green leaves in groups of three all along its stem. It can withstand the harsh interior Alaskan winter, and in some cases, it's been known to grow under ice cover. If the plant breaks apart, it can sprout new roots from the broken stem, which means it spreads quickly and easily.
Well, it's already in the Chena River as well. It's in very small patches there, but if that infestation grew, that could really impact the salmon habitat. The Chena and the Salcha River are major Chinook salmon spawning streams of the Yukon River drainage. And who knows, all the sloughs that are tributaries of the Tanana and the Yukon River were this plant could move into, because it's constantly spreading downstream.
Elodia is a popular plant to add to home aquariums, and it's likely someone dumped their fish, plants, and gravel into Chena Lake within the last decade. It's a story Rick Johnson has heard before. He's the Noxious Weed Control Coordinator for Thurston County in Washington State. In 1997, Brazilian Elodia was found in the Chehalis River, and it was up to Johnson to eradicate it.
It was something we couldn't ignore because it could no longer even get across the river. It was you could nearly walk across the river in like snowshoes or something. It was that invasive, and it wiped out all the other native plants. And it started to affect the temperature of the water, because the water slows down. It just can't flow as fast as it needs to. And the oxygen depletes.
Johnson is in Fairbanks to advise the development of a comprehensive plan to remove Elodia from area waterways. He used the suction dredging method on the Chehalis to remove more than 300,000 pounds of plant material. On the upside, he says Elodia makes great compost. Darcy Echeverry hopes to make it available for Fairbanks area gardeners beginning next summer. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Two former University of Alaska Fairbanks rifle team members are competing on the U.S. team at the London Olympics. Matt Emmons is a two-time Olympian who won gold and silver at the Games in 2004 and 2008. Jamie Byerly Gray scored a fourth and fifth in 2008. Gray competed in the air rifle event Saturday and finished fifth again, one spot behind Emmons' wife, Katerina, who shoots for the Czech Republic. Yai Siling of China won. Gray says the places in shooting are typically determined by shots just millimeters apart.
You know, we're trying to hit a dime at 50 meters.
Gray says once you have the physical skill set, shooting is all a head game. She puts a lot into optimizing her mental state for the intense competition, including mindfulness meditation.
Practicing being aware of what thoughts come into your mind and then being able to concentrate back on the present moment. You know, so many times people are practicing or competing and thinking about, oh, what am I going to do tonight, or what am I going to do tomorrow, or I have another match in a couple days. Well, all those thoughts, you know, when you have those thoughts, you're not thinking about what you're doing right now, which can definitely cause some mistakes.
While many Olympic sports are all about the spectacle and drama of head-to-head competition, Gray says shooting is different.
You know, you think of a lot of other individual sports, something like tennis, you are reacting to what someone across the net is doing. You know, they hit a shot back, you have to react to it. Well, for shooting, you have none of that. It's literally you and the target, and that's all up there.
Gray says the Olympics are unique in that the sport actually gets some media attention. Gray's next event is the three-position rifle on August 4th. Emmons is scheduled to compete in 50-meter prone and three-position rifle events August 3rd and 6th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Avtech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Avtech, Alaska's Institute of Technology. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth. And organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Two men from the Kuskokwim village of Kweethluk drowned in separate incidences within the past week. From member station KYUK, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Most recently, 34-year-old Yako Fisher was found deceased in the Inkayak River near the village of Eek. Earlier last week, Fisher and his wife had been berry picking and staying at a cabin about 25 miles up the river. On Thursday, Fisher left the cabin alone and headed downriver in a 16-foot Lund boat. The next morning, John Friendly, the village public safety officer in Eek, found that Fisher's wife was left alone.
I don't know how the call had come in, but the VPSO had information that she was up at the cabin and she was stranded because her husband hadn't returned yet.
Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters.
The VPSO went out there, picked her up, transported her back to Eek, and the search began.
Troopers and local search and rescue teams from Eek, Tututulak, Nepakiak, and Nebuskiak launched a search effort by plane and boat. They found Fisher's boat Friday night around 9 p.m., about 12 miles downriver from the cabin. However, poor conditions made recovery efforts difficult. Heavy rain and high winds continued Friday night and throughout Saturday. On Sunday, searchers dragging the river eventually recovered Fisher's body at about 3:30 p.m. He was in the water near where his boat was found. Earlier last week, in a separate case, 25-year-old George Maxey of Quithluk was found deceased in the Nebuskiak Slough, downriver from Quithluk. Local searchers believe Maxey's boat ran out of gas and he was attempting to paddle in a fish tote when he fell in. Peter Atchak with Bethel Search and Rescue.
We're speculating that he might have tried getting into a fish tote to try to make it to the other side of the slough.
Maxey's body was found July 24th after a day of searching. Troopers believe that alcohol was a contributing factor in both incidents. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, Office of Native Affairs and Policy, is visiting remote villages, hub communities, as well as Anchorage and Fairbanks, to learn about the obstacles Alaska Natives face in accessing the Internet. The visiting officials also held a training session Friday in Anchorage. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has the story.
The training for telecommunications service providers and tribal leaders included an overview of certain FCC regulations and outlined how to take advantage of programs and policies aimed at Native Americans. Keynote speaker U.S. Senator Mark Begich of Alaska told a group of about 50 people that providing fast, affordable, and reliable Internet access is a matter of doing the right thing.
Telecommunications and broadband and this connectivity is the access to equality in this generation.
Ralph Anderson is CEO of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation and co-chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives. He says he wants people in even the smallest, most remote Alaskan villages to be able to use today's technology.
I want the best for my people. We deserve it. I mean, the people in America have had this technology much longer than us. They've also had a 185-year head start on us, and we have a much shorter time to make up a great distance.
Jeffrey Blackwell is the chief of the Office of Native Affairs and Policy at the Federal Communications Commission. Responding to a question about U.S. Department of Commerce telecommunications and information administration grants, he says that funding has been zeroed out.
It is unfortunate and frustrating that at a time when we're able to have the horsepower to be able to remove the linchpins, the regulatory barriers to entry at the FCC, the money that supports native radio all of a sudden goes away.
Broadband and internet communication service providers transmit data via sections or bands of the radio frequency spectrum, which the government auctions to users, bringing in billions of dollars of revenue for the federal government. Begich told the audience he'd like to see some of those funds go to telecommunications programs, but he says because those revenues now go to other programs, and given the belt-tightening climate in Washington, that's not likely to happen. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
A month after an online campaign started an effort to send Miami singer Pitbull to Kodiak, Mr. Worldwide finally touched down on the island this morning. KMXT's Brianna Gibbs has more.
Pitbull, here he is!
It was
was Mr. Worldwide's first visit to Kodiak, and an impromptu one at that. In early July, the artist, whose real name is Armando Perez, said he would visit the Walmart with the most Facebook likes. When all was said and done, Kodiak Walmart's 72,000 likes took home the win and brought Pitbull to Alaska's Emerald Isle.
Thanks to Walmart, thanks to Sheets, and thanks to Dave Thorpe. You know, to him it was a big joke to send me out here, but to be honest with you, it's great. We were in Cleveland last night. It was about a 9-hour flight to get out here. We got to go right back now to go to Atlanta to be on tour, but it's always good to be around good people in an untouched environment, and to be honest, it's very, very, very beautiful here, and I definitely want to come back.
Boston Phoenix columnist David Thorpe, the man arguably responsible for Pitbull's visit to Kodiak, also made an appearance. Thorpe had started an online campaign to exile Pitbull to the most remote Walmart in the world. In a turn of events, Pitbull embraced the idea and even invited Thorpe to join him on his trip. Pitbull stepped up and offered to pay for his ticket, allowing the two to finally meet.
Yeah, I met him, and he said, if I keep BSing, then we're going to be going to the moon together. So I agree. I'm going to meet him on the moon. I consider that a promise. So Pitbull and I will definitely be going to space in 2013, and you can count on it, or else I'm a liar.
Because of the tight schedule, Pitbull didn't give a concert, but stuck around long enough to meet with Kodiak Mayor Pat Branson and Senator Gary Stevens.
Hey, Kodiak! Hey, Pitbull!
How you doing?
I'm going well. This is Senator Stevens. I'm Pat Branson. We're here to welcome you. Bienvenido!
Yeah, muchas gracias.
Yeah, de nada. It's not often that I get to present the key to the city to someone, but it's exciting that I'm presenting the City of Kodiak key to Pitbull.
Wow, thank you so much.
In addition to receiving the key to the city, Pitbull was entertained by local Aleutic and Polynesian dancers and other community groups. He also presided over a presentation of donations from the Walmart Foundation to local charities. The foundation gave $25,000 to Kodiak Senior Center and $10,000 to the local food bank. It was a quick visit, but Mr. 305 said he would be returning to the 907 soon and that he wouldn't forget Kodiak.
They were asking me if I'm going to mention Kodiak, Alaska in a record. I said, absolutely, we're going to mention Kodiak, Alaska.
In Kodiak, I'm Brianna Gibbs.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning Barnes and Mark Earhart in Bethel, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Wendy Jonathan from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at alaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.